Do you want to invest in lifestyle investor deals, save more on taxes, find like-minded and highly successful people to spend time with and to learn from? Apply to join the world's most exclusive mastermind that turns everyday people into savvy investors. You'll get access to private deals that are not available to the public. These deals have been sourced by me personally and de-risked through preferred investment terms, giving you an unfair advantage that most people just don't get. To learn more and apply, visit lifestyleinvestor.com/mastermind. Welcome to the Lifestyle Investor Podcast. Imagine being able to earn passive income, build long-term wealth, while gaining total freedom from your business or job. That's what lifestyle investing is all about. I'm your host, Justin Donald, and in less than 2 years, my investments drove enough passive income for both my wife and me to quit our jobs. And now I want to show you how to do the same. I want to teach you how to create wealth without creating a job. You'll learn the exact same investment strategies I used to multiply my net worth to over 8 figures, all before the age of 40. If you want to learn all about low-risk cash flow investing, achieve financial freedom, and live the life you truly desire, this podcast is going to show you exactly how to do it. Christian Mack is an enterprise software veteran and a master of securing 8- and 9-figure exits for his clients. Christian is the managing director at Lotus Innovations Fund, a private equity firm specializing in the lower to middle enterprise software and services markets. Under his leadership, Lotus has delivered double-digit returns by leveraging small businesses that don't have access to bank and private equity capital into highly profitable and fast-growing SaaS firms. Before that, Christian built a company called Resolve Systems from scratch and scaled it organically before securing a massive 9-figure exit. Now he's on a mission to help other business owners do the same. In this episode, we go over the lessons he learned during his journey from an aspiring professor to Fortune 500 consultant and successful business owner. You'll learn how he bootstrapped his first company, then how he scaled it from $0 to $50 million in revenue, his unique strategies for buying small IT companies and helping them land multi-million dollar exits, the importance of building businesses that don't rely exclusively on rockstar CEOs, and much more. One more thing before we get to today's interview. Christian has a special gift for Lifestyle Investor Podcast listeners. He's holding a live coaching call that will be answering some of your biggest questions around building and scaling 8- and 9-figure businesses. This call will cover topics such as structuring your organization for growth, how to streamline your sales pipeline for increased revenue, exit strategies, market comps and valuations, how to hire an executive team, and much more. And the best part is that you'll have the opportunity to submit your questions in advance. So even if you can't make the live call, your questions will still be answered during the session, and we'll make sure you get access to the recording. Given Christian's years of experience scaling companies and having massive exits, the wisdom that will be shared in this coaching session alone offers huge value. But that's not all he's giving away. As many of you know, I have a strong appreciation for fine wine, and Christian is also a bit of a connoisseur himself. And knowing that there's a lot of people in our audience that enjoy wine and the process of tasting good wine, Christian is also giving away a curated list of wines selected by himself and his personal sommelier, which will help you elevate your palate and explore the world of wine with a whole new level of appreciation. To get access to both these gifts, visit justindonald.com/101. Thanks for listening, and without further delay, my conversation with Christian Mack. All right. What's up, Christian? So glad to have you on the show.
Likewise. Thank you, Justin, for the opportunity.
Yeah, this is fun. Well, I've been looking forward to having you on because you have such an incredible story. You've done so many cool things in the space of enterprise software, and I'd love more people to learn, A, what you do, and B, to consider this type of investment for their portfolio, something that I have heavily invested in. It's something I know at one point you were all in, all your eggs were in this basket.
Absolutely.
And you're still, you know, heavily allocated to enterprise SaaS. So for people that don't know what enterprise SaaS is, can you explain that?
Yeah. So enterprise software, and specifically enterprise software as a service, which is enterprise SaaS, is basically business-to-business software. So this is the stuff that people really don't see. The big ones are like IBM, Oracle, SAP, but effectively it's technology that allows businesses to interact with one another and their communities that they serve. It's really important, kind of the plumbing and electrical. It's not very sexy, but at the end of the day, the Fortune 500 companies rely upon this to effectively drive revenues and profitability.
Now, there's a whole lot of SaaS companies, SaaS. When you think of software as a service, you've got B2C, and then you've got B2B, and then, you know, kind of your high level, though, and the enterprise. So can you break down all the different types of software as a service and why you like enterprise the best?
Yeah. So business to business. So let's start with business to consumer. So business to consumer would be things like Facebook, right? Google, any app that you guys use on your phone, anything that the average consumer basically uses to consume, you know, technology wise, consume information. Business to business software is effectively, you know, businesses interacting with one another. And effectively in order to ensure that the revenues and the service or product that they're selling is delivered. Enterprise business to business software is you know, even a higher level. So I typically define that as more Fortune 500, Fortune 1000. So these are billion-dollar companies. Their requirements of on the software side are much higher than the traditional small, medium-sized business. And so, you know, that's where the average check size is typically in the certainly six figures, if not seven figures, you know, on an annual basis. And so, and the reason why I like enterprise of software and business-to-business SaaS is because these are contracts that are 3 to 5 year long contracts. And the technology itself really, once it actually provides value, it's very, very sticky. One of the things that people don't quite, you know is that mainframe technologies have been around since the 60s. And JP Morgan is one of the largest consumers of mainframe technology today. And basically any credit card transaction that you use on Chase goes through a mainframe, you know, data center, either in Columbus, Ohio, or in Arizona. And you may ask yourself, well, why is that? Why don't they use the latest and greatest? And well, in enterprise software, what we find is that it needs to be so scalable that technology gets layered in, right? So, you know, mainframes serve a particular purpose really well. And so, you know, what they do in order to make it easier for people to use is they basically layer additional technologies on top of it. And so mainframes are here to stay. They'll be here for a long, long time, and which I really like, because unlike business to consumer, where one day the, you know, MySpace is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and the next day it's Facebook. It's a very fickle market. Versus enterprise software, there's so much effort and time and money, you know, put into implementing this software that once a technology kind of sticks out and is picked by Fortune 500 companies, they certainly don't want to rip it out. It's too costly. It's too much of a distraction and can create havoc depending on, you know, the outages that possible error could create.
And isn't there, like, so we've talked about enterprise with these Fortune 500, 1000 companies, but enterprise SaaS is also something that's used by government agencies too, right?
Oh yeah.
And it's a huge market because once you get some of these government contracts, I mean, you're in the money. Companies love to acquire businesses that have large government contracts, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Just like Fortune 500 companies, the Department of Defense, the government, they have kind of a reference IT architecture. And the whole idea is that, you know, anything that they do to scale or they do an operation or what have you, they rely upon that reference architecture to provide the underlying IT infrastructure to do so. These contracts are in the enterprise space, you know, Fortune 500 space, 3 to 5 year long contracts. In the government space, it's much, much longer. And so, you know, even though it takes a little bit more effort to get those contracts, once you get them, then yes, you are set for a very long time. And, you know, a lot of different government agencies will also basically approach you if you have one contract because you're authorized to do certain things. Like in my background, Department of Defense has always been kind of a customer base for us. And, you know, if you think about Department of Defense, it's not just the Pentagon, right? You're talking about NATO and, you know, all the other allies, right, for the United States and so forth. And so the opportunity to get very deep inside that industry is pretty significant once you're, you know, kind of check all the right boxes to fulfill the need.
Yeah, that's incredible. So if you talk about, like, my comparison is like with a triple net lease. Let's say that you own real estate, you find Fortune 500 company, maybe a Fortune 100 company to rent your space, and maybe they rent it for 10 years and you have these automatic rate increases every year. Maybe they sign a lease for 20 years. That lease is the most valuable at the beginning because you have them locked in. A lot of them are corporately guaranteeing this. And so you flip that to like the government side of things and they sign a really long agreement, which is maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 20 years, whatever it is. You now have created massive value for your company. Like right out of the gates, this thing is worth so much. So a lot of people, once they have these contracts, will turn around and sell it. Whereas other people that want it more as a lifestyle, I mean, you really only have to land one or two of these big contracts oftentimes, and you are set as a lifestyle business. And once you're in one government agency or one defense contractor, it's a lot easier to get the other ones.
Right.
I've done a bunch of investments where our tenants are government agencies, FDIC, defense contractors, Lockheed Martin, Bell Helicopter, you name it, the list goes on and on. And these are just some of the best, most unique contracts because they're backed by the government. You're going to get paid.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important if you're an enterprise software company to be very specific, you know, very focused, right? Don't be all things, all people. If you're good with regards to selling into the Department of Defense, then and say financial services, then stay focused on those industries, right? Because the cross-selling opportunities are huge in the government and enterprise software. If JP Morgan buys your product, more than likely Wells Fargo, Bank of America, all those guys are going to want to buy your product because they don't want to be left out in the wind. So it's very true within the government space as well. It's actually even more true because once you've survived the government procurement process, which is it's not an easy thing to do, but once you survive that and you're providing value and you're locked in, then it's so much easier to effectively pick up additional business in different departments and so forth. So yeah, it's a great point.
It's interesting hearing your story, and I'd love for you to share with my audience just kind of where how you got to where you are today, because you built a company from scratch, and you scaled this thing and had a massive exit, over a nine-figure exit,
yeah.
Or I should say well into the nine figures, and most people never experience that in their wildest dreams, but you have over and over had massive transactions in the enterprise SaaS space. So I'd love to hear how you got started and what kind of happened with that first company and how you pivoted to where you are today.
Yeah, so my story is kind of interesting. It breaks up into different kind of acts, right? So if I look at it like a story, first is, you know, I went to college, come from humble beginnings, you know, I had to put myself through school by taking on the odd IT job. I went to University of Chicago, was a math major on my way to get my PhD. Realized very quickly that I did not want to become a professor. And so, but I really love technology. And so when I graduated, you know, I like to joke around because I could spell IT and everyone was worried about the world falling apart due to Y2K. Those of you who are old enough to remember that, I was instantaneously qualified. I'm not much sure if qualified would be the right word, but to be a consultant. And so I did that for a couple of years. And so I did massive deployments into Fortune 500 companies. And I realized at that point, being kind of starting to become, you know, a successful consultant operator, that the next phase of my life was really, I really wanted to start my own business, right? And billable time was great, but there was only so much billable time in the day. So the next act came into play where basically I started my very first software company, and I did it. I carpeted the basement of my house that I had just bought. I put up whiteboards. It was a 4-bedroom, 2.5-bath house. I called up all the people I knew that I believed I could train up to basically start this great, you know, software company. And, you know, I told people that, hey, look, I really can't pay you very much, but I can give you room and board. And so we had 13 people living in a 2.5-bath house in the early days, and we grew it successfully. Before I did it, I called my parents up and I said, hey, you know, I'm basically starting this up on credit card debt. And I walked into a bank and said, hey, you know, I'm starting to think about starting a company, and you know, effectively the bank, I'm pretty sure, took my pulse and basically gave me 50 grand and said, hey, kid, don't spend this all in one place. And so off we were off to the races. It was an interesting time. We went from 0 to $50 million in revenue. It was definitely not a linear line. It was a roller coaster. There's lots of ups and downs. And what I realized during that, being an operator, is that there's a lot of different resistance points, right? There's a lot of different things you have to do from a back office and front office basis in order to have a successful business. And that's really stratified by revenue, because there's just different things when you're going from 0 to 1 million than you would do to go from 5 to 10 or 10 to 20 or 20 to 50. And that's really where my expertise kind of ended. But in 2000, the journey that I thought was going to be 3 years ended up being 13 years. So I took it, I did it all the hard way. So we never took on any investor capital, did it all organically. But ultimately, we had a 9-figure exit in 2012. So it took 13 years. But then that was a really good exit. And those 13 people became millionaires and more. So they did quite well. But we worked really hard during that time. But what I realized was that the reason why we're working so hard is because there was no playbook that we were really operating by in order to grow. We were all kind of figuring it out as we went, right? We committed and we were figuring it out. So once I sold, decided, I'm going to start a family office. So I started a family office called Terra Rosa, and I started to network with folks. And so that was kind of the next act in my story, because I went from being an operator, having a successful business, to then exiting and then starting a family office. And in doing that, I realized that a lot of these family offices were looking for technology investments, but the technology investments that they were being pitched, in my humble opinion, they had more chances of getting their money back going to Vegas and playing red on roulette, right? Than say, investing in these deals. And so, but at the same time, a lot of businesses, thanks to the Great Recession, a lot of small businesses in the enterprise software space were approaching me going, "Hey, Christian, I can no longer get that $50,000 check, right, that you got when you started your business." There's basically this capital desert for those companies that are too small for private equity and don't fit the venture capital model. And so, between, it's kind of like an aha moment. Had family offices looking to invest, and high net worth people looking to invest in technology, but didn't necessarily have the understanding around that. But the other hand, had really great small businesses that needed not only capital, but also the advice on those best practices to really scale from a front office and back office basis. And so we launched Lotus in 2014. Our first fund was, first and second fund were more of a proof of concept to really kind of prove around the thesis. But the whole goal was, let's go into these small businesses. We're a buyout fund. So let's take the majority control of these companies. And the founders, they're more likely more technologists than anything else. And so they really want to focus on the product anyway. So they become more of the CTO. We bring in a group that effectively kind of takes over the back office and front office, gets these best practices up and running. And we grow these companies. We grow it to the point where more traditional private equity or even public markets are interested. But when we buy it right. So we're buying a very low multiples relative to, we're talking about buying, call it 3x revenue versus the public markets are they're very, very high in multiple. But even private equity has historically, all throughout the decades, has bought for basically, call it 7 to 10x revenue. So there's huge multiple expansion there. But Fund 1 did really well. It did 2.3x return in 3 years. Fund 2, we started in 2016. That did extremely well, 42% gross IRR, 36.5% net IRR in 4 years. We ended up in 2020. And now we're on to our third fund, which is really exciting. And what's interesting about this kind of stage in my life is that since we've proven out the model, we've been able to hire some really grade A talent to fill out the team. So it's not just the folks that were operators. Now we have, kind of rounded out the team with people that not only understand technology, but also understand private equity and financial services, best practices, and so forth. So we're super excited about kind of scaling this up in a big way. Not so much that we're going to be buying bigger companies. I really believe that what we're doing from a mission perspective is important because it services that capital desert for these small businesses that don't have access to bank capital or private equity capital or anything like that. So there's a big need there that we service, which I think serves a greater good.
Yeah, that's incredible, Christian. You've had so much success over your career in this space. So here's one thing that I love is that everyone on your team, I think you said it was 13 people, all became millionaires, which how cool is it to know that you helped create millionaires amongst those people you gave the opportunity to be partners with in some way, shape, or form? I mean, that's incredible. You said something else that I think is really important, and I would like to elaborate a little bit, because earlier you said in the enterprise SaaS space, you get multiples, the valuation of the company is based on a 2x to 4x, or at least you're buying at a 2x to 4x based on revenue, not based on EBITDA. So this is a little bit different. Most businesses, like if you took account of every business out there, every industry, every niche, it's I mean, the vast majority, 98%, maybe it's 99% of businesses, their valuation is derived from some sort of profit margin or you know, profit formula. EBITDA is probably the most common. In real estate, it would be net operating income.
Sure.
There's free cash flow. There's all kinds of different things that people use to kind of like evaluate what is a company worth.
Yep.
But there are a few industries, enterprise SaaS being one of them, SaaS in general being one of them, where you get a valuation based on the top line revenue. Super rare. Talk about that a little bit, because that, I mean, that juices your returns.
Oh, yeah. No. And what's interesting about that is, look, when we buy companies, we're always buying companies that are break even or making money, right? You have to buy it right. You can't buy something because it's like, okay, great. It's got $7 million of revenue, but it's losing $2 million. That's not acceptable, right? So you've got to make sure to buy a company that's got the right fundamentals in general. And then our target actually is, once we buy it, to get it to 20% EBITDA or higher from a back office. So sustainable growth is core to our culture and super important. That being said, however, Justin, you're absolutely right. It is a little unique. Why do enterprise software companies, SaaS companies get this multiple on revenue? And the reason for that is that, unlike traditional businesses, in an enterprise software market, you can literally shut everything down with maybe a skeleton crew from a support perspective. And these contracts are usually like 3 to 5 years. You know, they're a lot longer in government. And that customer will continue to pay for that software package no matter what. And so all of a sudden, you're talking about, you know, businesses that have, what, 80, 90 plus percent gross margin. And so all of a sudden, that revenue can become, for the most part, EBITDA if you wanted to. And now most companies don't choose to do that because they want to continue to innovate so that they can gain more customers, so that they can, you know, basically expand into their existing customer base and so forth. But that's kind of unique in this industry, in that you can do that. And because the stickiness is there, because the contract length is there, the opportunity to effectively, if you wanted to, get it down to a skeleton crew and just basically take the cash out, is the reason why you can get these multiples. Because yeah, we're buying companies, call it, for on average 3x revenue, but we could literally, if we wanted to, basically get it down to a skeletal crew, and you know, probably 80-90% of it could be complete EBITDA of that revenue number. And so we would easily get our money back over a 3 to 5 year period. But when you're looking at private equity and public markets, you're talking about potentially 10 plus times revenue, because they're so bought into the fact that historically you could do that. And so therefore, these things are worth that much money. And that's what the market's willing to bear. So
I just wanted to take a quick moment to let you know about a special offer that I created for the Lifestyle Investor community. When I look back at my investing journey, there's one specific investment in particular that was the spark to increasing my net worth and allowing me to leave my job to become a lifestyle investor. I'm talking about mobile home parks. Yes, mobile home parks. If you just cringed a little, that's exactly why these provide such a great opportunity, because of the negative stigma and stereotype people might have. In reality, this is an incredible investment that you can get into with little or no money down. You can also quickly get a return on your capital. You can immediately cash flow on day one. You can hold it forever as a cash cow. You get accelerated depreciation to reduce or eliminate the taxes that you would owe. And often the seller will finance the deal, so you don't need a bank. You can also buy them at the highest cap rate of all real estate, meaning it's the cheapest real estate to buy based on the income that it generates. And it's the lowest default rate of all real estate, meaning it's the safest asset class to own in real estate. I use this asset class to start my journey in real estate investing and grow my net worth to over 8 figures, all before I turned 40. And out of all the questions that people ask me, how do I get into mobile home parks is still the number one question that I get, which is why I put together this Mobile Home Park Masterclass. This is a paid class that I'm offering for a limited time only. For all the details, head over to justindonald.com/MHP and watch the video, which outlines all the details about the class and exactly what you get when you sign up. You'll also hear the incredible success stories from students who have gone through my content and are now making hundreds of thousands of dollars in passive income. If you want to take the same first step that I did, that helped me take both my wife and I from working full-time jobs to becoming lifestyle investors, Join me in my Mobile Home Park Masterclass, and let's get started on your journey to becoming a lifestyle investor. Visit justindonald.com/MHP for all the details. Yeah. So thank you for kind of diving into that, because I think it's an important distinction where there are a few others that are kind of like this. You have a lot of technology is going to have a multiple of revenue. You know, I think like e-commerce specifically, think marketplaces, even on the franchisor side of things, you'll sometimes see a multiple. Generally, it's still a multiple of EBITDA. It's just way higher than on the franchisee side if you're just selling a franchise or a few franchises versus the whole franchise, right?
Right.
So you get these increased multiples. But on that revenue side, that's a big, I mean, part of the reason why I got into investing in enterprise SaaS was because these exits could be massive. And some of the cool stuff you're doing is you're taking companies public. You've done this several times before. You've even done some unique strategies where you've taken 10% of a company public on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and then you're going to wait a period of time, use that money wisely, and then take the rest of it public on the NASDAQ, right? Talk about that, because that is a really unique strategy that I haven't really heard anyone else doing.
Yeah. So above and beyond our 8% pref, which we try to target to be a dividend, right, every quarter. And if for whatever reason we don't hit that threshold, it kind of continues. One of the things that's interesting is being able to provide investors with the ability to have liquidity. So things happen in life. A lot of times it's very unfortunate situations, but being able to provide liquidity is important. Well, how do you do that? Well, in order to do that, it's really helpful to have your assets that you acquire have a market-to-market valuation. Well, how do you accomplish that? Well, you know, basically, and Justin, you hit it, right? You take basically after you acquire the company, after you basically implement value add, there's an opportunity at this point to inject even more capital into it in order to make supercharge it. Historically, what we've done as a fund is we would just write that check ourselves. But the public markets are willing to pay, even today, a lot higher a multiple than the 3x revenue that we're willing to buy it at for this particular growth around. So what we do is we basically float 10%. We basically go live in the Toronto Stock Exchange. And people ask all the time, like, well, why the Toronto Stock Exchange? And it's like, well, believe it or not, Toronto Stock Exchange is very attracted to companies that are enterprise software companies that are smaller, right? You know, we're buying companies that are between $5 and $10 million, ideally. And so they really like that. You don't necessarily get the attention of the NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange with such a small company. However, in Toronto, you can. But once you go through that process, the 10% that you floated, right, gets injected into the company. That allows the company to get supercharged. There, in doing that, you also have a market-to-market evaluation for that company. And the liquidity provider that we work with allows people to potentially sell their position within the fund at around 20% discount to NAV. And so that's huge. And you can accomplish all that by going down this path. But by doing that, now that you're on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and oh, by the way, all of our companies are audited. We have to go through all the typical things that you would do as a public company anyway. And so there's not much more work that has to be done in order to go public. And it's a big pain in the butt if you're private and you're not audited and all that stuff. But because we're mandated through our fund to do this, and it's honestly just one of those best practices, we're already doing that, we might as well accomplish that. But once we've listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange for a year and our market cap is in excess of 100 million, which by the way, historically, even today, I mean, you're talking about valuations that are called 12 to 15 times revenue. It's not that hard to get to $100 million market cap. Once you're able to do that, you're able to easily cross list into NASDAQ, because then NASDAQ and the Toronto Stock Exchange have an agreement that allow people to kind of cross list across the board, but they have to meet certain requirements. And so then you land into the NASDAQ world, and that's obviously that's a larger market and allows a lot of great synergies there too. So that's why we do this. Oh, by the way, by doing this, we always talk about selling to private equity. We talk about, going public, but by and large, as you go through this process and you go public, what's interesting is that a lot of strategics actually will pick up on this great little enterprise software company that's out there. And when I say strategic, I mean, big companies like big enterprise software companies like SAP, IBM, Oracle, these companies pay attention to the public markets. And if they see that a smaller public market is doing well and it fits in their kind of mandate, then they'll pick it up for a tremendous multiple because they don't care about the historical financial multiples. What they care about is we'll buy something for 30 times revenue if we believe that we can make hundreds of millions of dollars on it within our customer base. And so that awareness is much more visible in the public market world, it's a win-win all across the board.
Yeah. And it's also, I think, important to note that strategics buy companies not like, yeah, they want to make money. They want to make a good investment, but often they'll buy a company because it's a value add to their current ecosystem, to their customers, what they can roll out. So they can often buy a company for a crazy multiple because it never has to make money. They can just use that as like a plus one with interface with clients or whatever that looks like. And so that's kind of a unique strategy with the strategics. Now, something I do want to say, there are a few things. Number one, you talked about the Toronto Stock Exchange. And for those that are unfamiliar, it is way cheaper to go public on the Toronto Stock Exchange. It's way shorter of a timeline to go public. You can do this in way fewer months, almost half the time. And then on top of it, there are less hoops to jump through. So I know a lot of people that opted not to go public in the US and go public in Canada. So what's interesting about yours is you're kind of getting like you're juicing the returns. You're getting this extra money that then you can put forward. And then you already have the proof of concept that you already went public with part of the company. Therefore, it's an easier transition on the NASDAQ or in this case, it's the NASDAQ, right?
Absolutely.
So that's really cool. And then another thing I want to point out is you're only buying profitable companies, like EBITDA positive, like worst case, it's break even. But the moment you own it, you can strip out because you already have a team. I mean, these are really smart people that start these companies, but they're not CEOs, they're CTOs. Right. And so you find the right people to plug in. You get a CTO not juggling two roles of being CTO and CEO and probably COO, and you just get them focusing on that technology and building it out. So you're buying cash flow positive. You've already got a good multiple. You're buying under market. Often you're buying unlisted, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so you're kind of in the money day one. And then the goal is, how do we get the most value? Is the most value from a strategic or is the most value from going public?
Right.
And I would say it probably depends. And there are pros and cons to both, right?
Definitely. For us, it's good to have options. And at the end of the day, we never rely upon or assume that we're going to get bought by a strategic. And so if we, as going through this path, we can leverage the public markets, we can leverage traditional private equity. But if a strategic comes along and is willing to pay multiples on multiples, then that's a win for everybody. One thing I will say is that, and Justin, you hit on this, is one of the reasons why we hold companies for 5 years is because we want to leverage a program called QSBS, which is Qualified Small Business. And what that does is it allows any of our investors to come on board. And assuming we buy it the right way, which we target to do, and we hold it for 5 years, because these are small businesses, typically they're way less than 50 million. Typically they're 5 to 10 million. And you hold it for 5 years, then when we do actually sell the equity, it's usually tax-free, capital gains tax, federal capital gains tax-free. So that's a huge value add to the ecosystem as well. And 5 years is it seems like a long time, but in reality, it's something where it takes a while to implement value add. It takes a while to grow. It takes a while to go public. And so being able to establish an assembly line of sorts of all these different companies that are in process in parallel, it's an exciting time and it's a win for investors too. So,
yeah. And I think you have to have a C corp, right? In order for that to,
that's right.
To, you know, there's like a few stipulations, that being one of them. So I'm sure that's one of the things you look at when you buy companies or how quickly you could transition something operating as an LLC or subchapter S corp. And then you just transition it probably to a Delaware C corp, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a process, but it's good to do. And it's a huge benefit for everybody, including the founders themselves, because the founders, they still have a significant chunk, you know, whether it's 49% or 30%. I mean, we want to make sure that we have a successful exit for our investors, first and foremost, of course, but also these founders, it's better to have a smaller piece of a much bigger pie. And doing so in a tax efficient way makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And so right now there's some market turmoil. There's definitely some turmoil in the tech sector, right? I'm curious how this impacts what you're seeing. And I know this is kind of like an outlier in tech in the fact that as the market gets worse, it actually gets better for people that are in a position to acquire because you can get stuff on sale. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. So our strategy has always been, like, my company was an automation company. It has always been to focus on 9 segments within enterprise software. And so these segments do well during good times, but they do even better during downturns. And the reason for that is because they're all efficiency oriented. And so Fortune 500 companies have to deliver the same product or service with less people in a recession. And they rely upon enterprise software, ironically, during those times. So they'll invest in it in order to drive even more efficiency. And so these segments do really well. That being said, it's certainly good to be in a position where these companies that we buy are all off-market deals, they're all pocket deals, right? So we've always bought companies around the, you know, call it 3x revenue basis. And today I would say that we're still buying companies for 3x. It's not like that's really dropped at all. But what I will say is that the quality and the quantity of deals has certainly increased due to the fear, uncertainty, and doubt out there. Because we'll run across, and Justin, you hit upon it, we're buying profitable companies. So you have to convince an owner that, hey, look, you know, I want to partner up. I want to give up control. And that's a big deal, especially when some of these companies before the bear market, were trading at some crazy multiples. Now, today, everyone's like much more open and willing to partner up together. So it's good to be in a kind of a buying value add position for sure. And we're getting a lot of good quality deals, which is great to see.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about how this is really a recession-proof industry. And if you look back to the dot-com crash and the financial crash of 2008, you picked up some of the best deals that you ever had during those times. And so while a lot of people were freaking out, most people were freaking out, you're on a shopping spree to get the best companies that are at a great price. And I just think that that's just a brilliant way to do it. I also am very impressed with your track record, because generally you're going to have some duds. Like, you now have, you started your company, you sold it, you invested in some one-off companies, then you started a fund. You're like, hey, I'm actually pretty good at not just starting my own company, but I now know how to invest. And so that first fund was like 10 companies. And then the second fund was about a similar size, maybe a little bit more. And now you're on a third fund that's probably going to be a similar size, could be even more based on the fact that you've raised more than you ever have based on your track record. And one of the things that I was thinking about with just the market, the opportunity, is you've had very few losses. I think you've had like 2 duds that didn't work out. And I think in each case, it was because you made the decision not to sub out the CEO and let them keep running it, even though all the other times you trusted your gut. And this was early on. And those are the hard lessons where you said, all right, now, always, when we buy a company, we move the CEO to CTO, and then we bring in someone professional. So there haven't been too many duds, but there have been a couple, and you've learned from them. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's tough, right? So when you buy a company, especially when you buy 51%, the reason why our value is created is because we implement our value add, right? So if you come across, if you pick the best location, you come across a building that just really needs a lot of renovation, you have to implement that renovation, right? You have to implement that value add. And so what's difficult in small companies is that that tends to be a cultural change. And you really need to have somebody at the top that supports that cultural shift, because you are coming in and you are implementing best practices from front office and back office basis, so that you can attain sustainable growth, which we define as 20% year over year in or more in EBITDA, as well as 20% year over year in revenue growth, if not more. And so that cultural change is important. And, you know, one of the lessons learned is that that's tough for some employees to swallow. And having a new leader or a leader that supports that cultural change is super important, so that value add can be implemented. And so that's definitely kind of a big lesson learned. And the good news about this is that as we make mistakes, right, and we're not perfect, right, we basically learn from these things. We iterate our process because we're constantly acquiring, we're constantly implementing value add, we're constantly kicking off processes to go public and things of that nature. And as we get bigger and bigger, it's all about scaling those best practices from a fund perspective too. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, there's so much we could go through. I feel like I wish we had more time, because I know you're an avid wine collector and connoisseur. So we definitely didn't do a good job of getting into that. And I know you're moving your headquarters or part of your headquarters to Austin. Which is great. And I know you're spending more time here, probably splitting time, which is so cool. I'm excited to hang with you more and drink some epic wine together.
Definitely.
You had mentioned one thing. I'd love a quick answer on this for my audience, and then we'll kind of wrap things up. you had mentioned your family office, Terra Rosa, and you guys are doing some cool events and cool things. I feel blessed and privileged to have been able to participate in some of the cool trips and events you guys have organized. And I just want to give props there. But can you help my audience understand what a family office is, why someone would start a family office?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot. So when you do come into large sums of money, I think you really have a choice. You have the choice number one is the more traditional route, which is, you know, to basically hand that wealth over to a wealth manager like a Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, what have you. There's a lot of good people in those organizations, right? But for those within those organizations, sometimes, you know, there's conflict that exists, right? So because the compensation with employees inside of those areas is effectively the point where like, you know, you get paid potentially, you know, to get into certain deals and into certain products and so forth. And so, you know, if you establish a family office, the opportunity there is to basically allow hire people to effectively come on board and be full-time staff or even part-time staff. You can outsource this too. And the goal is to basically drive investments and things of that nature that are set up around the policies and procedures that you set up within there. So the definition that I use is when you're at a point where the majority of your wealth is managed by full-time or part-time people that you have specifically contracted out with, then it's a huge win. And so that is a family office in my definition. But there is no formal definition around a family office. It's just basically you have staff that manages things, manages your wealth, which is there's pros and cons to it. I think it's a pro by and large, but every situation is different.
Well, I love it. Well, I think everyone listening probably that hasn't established this aspires to have their own family office one day, which is really cool. So we appreciate you sharing this because you definitely are motivating many here to be able to kind of upgrade and move to the next level of wealth, wealth building, wealth management. So if people want to learn more about you or more about Lotus Domain, where can they go check you out?
Yeah, so they could go to our website. It's www.lotusdomaine.com. And yeah, go to the website, check us out. We'd love to talk to anybody who's interested. And certainly, thank you again, Justin, for this great opportunity. I'd love to continue to talk about wine, setting up family offices, fun. These are all kind of passions of mine, but certainly appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, man.
Well, I think this could be fun. We could do round two with the mastermind and with the lifestyle investor community. You can share some of the hacks that you've learned. So
absolutely.
Yeah, that's cool. I just want to give a real quick plug for anyone that's interested in kind of upgrading their game. Apply to the world's most exclusive mastermind for savvy investors looking to gain control of time and to upgrade and build their wealth by looking for invisible deals that have been pre-vetted and pre-negotiated with preferred terms that de-risk it and accelerate the overall capital that someone can make. Check it out at lifestyleinvestor.com/mastermind. And I will wrap today up the way I wrap up every week, which is this: what's one step you can take today to move towards financial freedom and a life you truly desire on your terms, a life not by default, but by design. Thanks, and we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening to the Lifestyle Investor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe so future episodes are automatically downloaded directly to your device. You can also leave an honest rating and review over on iTunes. Not only do I read every single one, but it also helps me understand what content matters the most to our audience. And if you can think of one or two people who could benefit from this episode, would you share it with them right now? Who knows? Maybe they'll buy you something nice when they make their first million. If you would like access to today's show notes, including links to all the resources mentioned, visit www.justindonald.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week for another episode of The Lifestyle Investor.